to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I am your host today, Jim Werbel, on this gorgeous Friday. On today's show, we'll be talking to Peter Rossum and Clark Wolf. Both are professors at ISU. And we'll be talking about the topic of Commonwealth. It's a topic that is not commonly discussed, but as the political season is approaching, it would be nice to hear candidates thoughtfully talking about this issue. I hope you can use this discussion to inform your thoughts on key political issues. I will then be talking to Mary Rankin, who works with both Live Green at ISU and City of Ames sustainability efforts. Today, we will be talking about the City of Ames efforts to be more sustainable. This topic is also linked to Commonwealth, as having a sustainable city increases our Commonwealth. I was fortunate to interview Clark Wolf and Peter Rossum about the topic of Commonwealth. We begin by talking about what is our Commonwealth. As we also learn, it's less than easy to define. Out of curiosity, we have four states that call themselves Commonwealths. That's Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Kentucky. According to Wikipedia, this designation, which has no legal meaning at all, emphasizes that they have a government in quotations marks, based on the common consent of the people. Let's see how closely the discussion matches that. I would like to welcome Peter Rossum, a professor of economics at Iowa State University, and Clark Wolf, a professor of philosophy at Iowa State University, to the show to talk about Commonwealth. I'd like to ask each of you, what elements do you consider to be a part of the Commonwealth?
Good morning, and thank you for inviting us here. I guess I'd like to begin with the word Commonwealth and its history, because it comes from a British concept of the common good. And Commonwealth was supposed to be refer to arrangements that really were to everyone's advantage. But I want to also think in that regard about what the British Commonwealth was like in, say, the late 19th to the early 20th century. It included India. It included all of the British Commonwealth's satellite nations. And I think that's interesting because it shows that the word Commonwealth can be used to defend institutions that really are indefensible. Well, I think the rhetoric of Commonwealth was used to justify things that were not at all in everyone's everyone's interest.
Even though another way of looking at Commonwealth is common weal, or the will of the people. And I think that's sort of what the philosophy behind the Commonwealth was supposed to be, is the will of the people in self-governance of the United States.
What should be a part of the Commonwealth in your opinions? Well, we will be relating it to it. What is not a part of the Commonwealth?
You know, I think I would like to think about not just what is part of the Commonwealth, but what issues and effects can be damaging to the public good and how we can avoid those. So one of the issues is defining the Commonwealth and defining what the public interest is or what the common interest might be. It turns out to be a very difficult thing to do. In this case, I think it's often easier to identify what's bad than it is to identify what's good.
If I could, I'd like to go back to how Commonwealth was being defined early on in the American Revolution, because if you go back to the Declaration of Independence, the role of the Commonwealth effectively came down from the British philosophers, Adam Smith, John Locke, I think, being the two prominent ones that were Thomas Jefferson was reading of the Declaration of Independence. So remember, in the Declaration, we have certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you go to John Locke, the role of the government was to protect an individual against the loss of their life, health, liberty, and possessions. And if you go to Adam Smith, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And so the role of government in John Locke is to protect the individual's rights to those inalienable rights of life, liberty, health, and possessions. And the Commonwealth was going to prevent the usurpation of those by the center. And I think if you look at sort of the writing of the Constitution in the United States, we start off with a Bill of Rights. These are the individual rights that people have. And then we start building in the role of government afterwards in terms of, okay, and under what circumstances are we going to have government action that may limit some of those individual rights but for the common good. And I think that tension is continued on through the history of the United States.
One of the things I wanted to say, I mean, life, liberty, and property, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I kind of like the way Jefferson did that, even though I think property rights are appropriate, legitimate rights. Neither Jefferson nor Locke thought those were the only fundamental innate rights that we possess. Both Jefferson and Locke thought that the number of rights or the set of rights we possess as individuals is innumerable. And one of the crucial obligations of a constitutional government is to avoid institutions that incur on people's individual rights.
Let me push you a little bit more here. Let's talk about wealth, which we talked about in an earlier show. Is financial wealth part of the Commonwealth or individual rights?
I think that from a philosophical standpoint as well as an economic standpoint, the protection of individual property rights is critical to the success of a nation. States that don't protect individual property rights tend to deteriorate and tend to revert to dictatorships that can be extremely damaging to individual citizens in the state. If you think back at the time of the writing of the Declaration of Independence, you also have the French Revolution. And they did not – it wasn't life, liberty, and property. It was égalité, liberté, and something.
Fraternité,
right? Brotherhood. But egalitarianism, I think, was – or equal was part of that. And that was not what they were thinking about in Jeffersonian United States. I think they were thinking more of the individual pursuit of individual wealth as also being part of the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would want to agree in a reserved way with that, because I also think that economic rights are real rights. Jefferson regarded them as fundamental rights. Potential tension, actually a very real tension, between inequalities and fundamental institutions that protect basic rights, like democracy. So, for example, it turns out that in circumstances where people with enormous wealth can have enormous influence on democratic institutions, inequalities in wealth can undermine the very institutions that we need to protect basic rights. But I'd also want to note that when inequalities rise to enormous levels, inequalities in wealth translate to inequalities in power. And I don't know that democracy can survive in circumstances of dramatic inequalities in power.
This is KHOI Radio 89.1 FM, serving Ames and Story City. I'm in the middle of an extended interview with Peter Arazem and Clark Wolf regarding the topic of Commonwealth. The first section discussed what is the Commonwealth. The next section of the interview, we use the case of Hoglots to discuss the topic of Commonwealth. This is a very lively discussion, as you'll soon hear, and Peter and Clark have very different images of managing the tensions between individual and collective rights. So the two of you are telling me that there's a lot of tension between individual rights and the common weal or the Commonwealth. And people can be reasonable and actually disagree about these issues. But let's just take an issue. Hoglots and air pollution. I live in North Ames, and every now and then I catch a whiff of smell that I don't like. I would consider this air pollution. People who have hoglots have the right to use their land for agriculture. This is at Iowa. Farms, by definition, have a certain degree of smell. Hoglots obviously intensify that smell, and the smell carries a much greater distance than a farmer spreading manure on the field. So how does one deal with this in terms of the Commonwealth? My Commonwealth is being diminished, but there's this individual rights of a property owner who has the right to do agriculture with their land.
Well, they have the right up to the point where they're doing damage on their neighbor. You don't have the right to do the damage on your neighbor. And if you damage your neighbor, then you should be obligated to make that good.
But and Peter, when I smell those hog lots, I'm disadvantaged. Aren't I damaged?
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't get compensation. What's going down here?
No, it's absolutely the case. There was a study at Iowa State, some of my colleagues in the economics department, where they looked at property values upwind and downwind and in proximity to large hog operations. And there's a 2% lower resale value of land within a mile downwind of a hog lot. It was 8% lower property values within a quarter mile of the hog lot downwind, and no impact up to the actual dollar value of that damage.
But what if I'm disadvantaged in ways that don't affect my wealth? So I mean, I might just not like the smell.
I'm not free to go outside when it stinks.
Well, I mean, if I'm especially sensitive to smell, I might be disadvantaged, even though the value of my house isn't perceptibly affected.
Well, one could argue that the value of the house is sort of what other people are viewing as that cost. But then should you be compensated for driving past, for example, as opposed to residing? And obviously, Jim is saying that he doesn't like the smell on occasion in North Ames. And I will tell you that it progresses on toward West and South Ames as well, where we live. And I remember, what do they call that, the smell of money or something along those lines?
That's an excuse that people use in many places.
Absolutely.
You know, the smell of money. I think it's true in some cases. I think that in many cases, what we're incurring are disadvantages associated with an industry that gives us advantages that might counterbalance the disadvantages we incur.
Don't the hog lots add to our wealth in some ways?
Well, they end up obviously having a private good. The public bad is actually protected by the common weal, right? We have state law that says that the locality cannot exercise jurisdiction over agriculture. What is it? The Freedom to Farm Act,
right?
I believe.
Now, that, I think, is a really interesting place to go, because that is one of these places where the democratic process is, well, curtailed at least by considerations of individual rights. In this case, individual rights of the pork-producing corporations.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something different, that the democratic process removed the ability to seek redress.
There are different ways to understand it. But at one level, at the local level, people perceive this as a case where I can't outvote my vote doesn't get any weight against this farmer up the road whose activity is disadvantageous to me.
I agree. I mean, if you look at how we allocate votes, right, we don't have a free democracy. We have a representative democracy, and that democracy is sort of set in part on the basis of the weight of population and in part on the basis of the weight of location.
Go ahead.
I just want to say this is a case where local democracy and state level democracy appear to be in conflict, right? At the state level, we've put in place laws that restrict the ability of local democracies to govern their own circumstances. And that might be appropriate. I think it is absolutely appropriate in some circumstances. There are other circumstances where I think it's inappropriate, right? I mean, in the case of hog lots and hog effluent, I want to know what the influences were on the legislators who voted for that, because this is a context where money and power can have a great influence. And when these things are voted on at the state level, people as individuals are often unaware of what the state legislature is doing.
State legislature did put some restrictions on hog lots. They cannot be within but 2 miles of a city. Sure, they had some restrictions on the management of waste from the hog lot. So they did some things to curtail the freedom to farm.
And they have the right to fine individuals whose runoff then leads to fish kills.
Interesting. Now, one effect that these things have is on immediate neighbors. So we're talking about hog farms and smell. And smell is a very local problem. But there are effects of hog lots and Iowa agriculture that extend far beyond our state as well. And there's an issue of who gets to vote when on issues when our activities impose negative effects on distant other people. And you know, some of those people are distant because they live in other states. Some of those people are distant because they don't exist yet. Our present activities are imposing environmental costs on the world that will influence the lives of subsequent generations of human beings who aren't here yet to have their voices heard. There's no way to have them vote.
I know some people think that if the EPA does its work with river pollution, that it's going to, Iowa agriculture will have to change because we are significantly contributing to, as well as Illinois and some other major agricultural states, to the dead zone in the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true, and you can then view the national government as imposing its will on states and local governments as the opposite example, where you may have stronger taste for environmental redress at the national level than at the state level.
The Commonwealth is complicated because, okay, so we get cleaner air, but then the common will suffers because we will have to pay more for our energy. So even the Commonwealth has inherent conflicts within its desires, which then adds to the political discourse.
Absolutely. Peter's right to point out that we often perceive things to be promoting the Commonwealth than when they're promoting our interests. But I think we need to absolutely respect and we do encounter contexts where people say, look, this is a costly program. It's going to disadvantage me, but it's fair. It's required by fairness to other people. We don't have the right to impose undue costs on others. So when our activities do that, we need to start paying those costs.
So I'm suggesting that the two of you, are in consent with this, that Commonwealth deals with the concept of public fairness.
Absolutely.
I think it deals with the concept of public fairness, and it deals with the adjudication of individual versus public rights.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing about fairness? Because we could come to an agreement among the three of us about what's fair for us.
Right.
And that might be one agreement. If we were to include the people in the other room, that agreement, all right, the agreement we three make might not at all be adequate for
if
that.
If the Cook brothers were here, they'd have a different opinion
absolutely
about what's fair.
Whenever you speak of fairness, it raises that question, who's my neighbor, right? Who is included in the group that is taken into account when we're deciding who's fair? Is it people in Ames? Is it people in Iowa? Is it people in the United States? Is it everyone in the world? Is it everyone in the world plus the people whose lives will be influenced even though they don't exist yet? And we can answer questions of fairness at each of those levels, but the conclusions we come to at each level may be problematic if at the next level it turns out there's someone we left out and they're being shafted.
This is KHOI Radio, 89.1 FM, serving Ames and Story City. This is Local Talk, and I'm Jim Werbel, your host today. I'm having an extended interview with Clark Wolf and Peter Rossum regarding Commonwealth. If you've just joined us and finding this topic at all interesting, you can listen to the full interview by going to our website, khoifm.org, and going to Local Talk Podcasts. So far, Peter and Clark have talked about what is Commonwealth, and we talked about Commonwealth in terms of hoglots. There's a delicate balance between individual rights and collective rights, as well as who participates in that discussion of collective rights. Next, the three of us talk about the political discourse, or lack of it, regarding Commonwealth. Let's listen to the final segment and see what each constructively offers to have more thoughtful political action.
Let's talk about what government can do to increase the Commonwealth and protect the Commonwealth.
Well, I think one of the issues here is at which level do you want to start? Do you want to start at the level of the individual rights and then say, where are we going to abridge those for the common good? Or are you going to start with a common good and then say, where can we allow individual rights? You get very different answers depending on which of those you start with. And my suggestion is that one of the reasons that the U.S. has been relatively successful both as a democracy and as an economy is it started with what does an individual need to be able to do to protect and generate for their own welfare, and then how are we going to protect those that ability for the public good, and then where are we going to bridge those rights?
I would join Peter in advocating a start from a vision of individual rights, and that the initial role of government is to secure those rights. Right, Jefferson, reading Locke, said we have these rights, but if we don't have a government in place, they're insecure. We need government institutions to make us safe in the possession of those rights. But I think we're in a different position in one important respect right now. I do think that we need to think about the institutions that are protecting our rights and their perpetuity. We need to think about their security. I think democracy is one of those institutions, and I think democracy is fragile. One of the things that renders democracy fragile are radical inequalities in power. And in a context where there are radical inequalities in wealth and people have radically different abilities to influence political outcomes, I think we can't be ideally secure in those rights that Peter's identifying here. So even
but
if you start
the Supreme Court, as we all know, with Citizens mm-hmm. United, basically
right.
says it's the right of because of the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, we can't restrict people's ability based on money to restrict their freedoms.
Well, I think it's a disastrous decision. But if you read that decision, there's a real issue that sits at the basis of the Supreme Court's concern, and that is that it's hard to identify an appropriate way to restrict campaign funds that's fair and doesn't inappropriately intervene in people's lives. I don't think that the status quo is in any way acceptable.
I guess I'm a little bit more skeptical as to how effective just pure money is. If you look at the last few elections, you can't click to the next channel fast enough when a political campaign comes on because they're so horrible. And I mean, if I remember Iowa, I mean, was it only a year ago? Some of the campaigns, I knew nothing about what was positive about any of the candidates. But for God's sakes, I knew what was wrong with them. Not only that, but being thoughtful is hard.
Yeah, that's true.
To actually think hard about how to solve a problem requires that you actually do real analysis as opposed to simply pontificating. And pontificating mm-hmm. is relatively easy. Not to say anything about the Pope, who I assume works really hard at pontificating, but at least he's infallible.
Why can't government have a discussion, a little like we're doing, just talking about, well, there's these individual rights and there's these collective rights, and we're at one of those crux points, such as hoglots, all right? So what is stopping that kind of civil discussion?
I'm a real fan of the Supreme Court and the judicial system in general, and the types of questions that we put to what amounts to an elite group of educated individuals. And we may disagree with how they're going to come up with a result, but they're actually undertaking these sorts of discussions all the time. And sometimes, I mean, you know, there's egregious decisions that have been reversed over the length of time, such as the ones that certified slavery. On the other hand, you get Brown versus Topeka Board, which you could say sort of jump-started the whole civil rights movement. Or you could look at the role of the courts in same-sex marriage. We didn't have a lot of elections that supported same-sex marriage. In fact, you didn't have a lot of majorities of populations that supported same-sex marriage. But both going back to Loving versus Virginia, where black-white marriages were legalized by the Supreme Court, even though it was illegal in numerous states. And now you have the law of the land basically saying that if you're going to protect individual rights and you're going to defend them consistently, you can't make that contingent on gender.
I think that's a great case of individual rights versus majoritarian resistance. When Loving versus Virginia was decided, a majority of Americans were opposed to interracial marriage. Now, when the Supreme Court decides the gay marriage case, it's not clear whether there's still a majority. Actually, some polls have it at that there's a small majority in favor of gay marriage.
But I was also thinking of state state Supreme Court case versus.
Absolutely.
In Iowa,
right.
it was the minority that was supportive of same-sex marriage at the time of the case.
I think we're going to. I mean, I think Iowans mostly identify the Iowa Supreme Court case as a success, and I'm confident that we're going to come to regard the Supreme Court case as one of those excellent cases where individual rights were upheld against, in this case, what, you know, perhaps a large group of Americans would prefer.
Well, thank you.
May I add one, revisiting something that's old?
Go ahead.
But we were talking about the influence of money on elections.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that the way that money influences elections most pronouncedly is not that people buy political campaign advertisements and that forms public opinion, so much as that in order to compete effectively in contemporary political climate, you need to have a huge war chest. And if you don't have it, you will lose.
Right.
But the money that comes into those war chests comes with obligations. And there are studies that show that our American politicians are deeply responsive to the organizations that donate to their campaign fund.
Well, I guess I would say that the evidence isn't uniform on that, because what they do find is that effective candidates attract more money, in part because you want to be part of the winning team. And so when they actually look at very narrowly decided elections, mm-hmm. Money does not predict which of the two mm-hmm. parties are going to win. Where I do see it making a huge effect is at the national level. So right now you had mentioned the Koch brothers, and you've got what? How many Republicans are now currently in 17?
17.
And so the Koch brothers hosted a group where individuals were invited. Not all 17 were. Donald Trump, for example, was certainly not invited to attend. And one could argue that that is where the influence is really going to be felt.
Well, the two of you have highlighted some major issues in terms of individual rights versus collective rights, which are part of the Commonwealth. And I think you've summarized in saying that there's a lot of Supreme Court, legislative, individual actions that have an ongoing dialogue between the inherent tension between these two. It covers many issues. We've just talked about a few of them, not very many of them. Would you like to add anything else to this topic before we close?
I've had the privilege of being on the Ames City Council now for 5 years. And what I'm amazed with is how well government works at the local level. We have a nonpartisan city council. And the issue is always in trying to hash out, okay, what is going to be our solution? That doesn't mean we agree on everything. But at least we have, I think, a reasonably intelligent discussion between people who disagree and try to figure out, okay, how are we going to solve this particular problem at the local level? I mean, my own experience is that local government seems to be much more effective than national government right now in actually trying to hash out problems.
Well, I served on the school board when I was in high school, and what I remember about that group, that small local group, was that it was incredibly divisive. They were divided on issues that really did not seem to reflect their underlying antagonism to each other. And what I remember is we had a load shedder that they were gonna – it was gonna save money in the long run, and we voted it down because it was going to be an increase in the budget for this year, even though it would have saved us money for, you know, over thousands of dollars over the following years. What I think is different in that case from what Peter is describing in the local government here is an underlying culture of trust, an underlying culture working towards something that is a commonwealth, like something like the common good. Look at the difference between politics in Iowa and politics in Wisconsin right now. All right. Right now, Wisconsin is a divided state. People can't talk to each other about political issues. It's more like my school board and less like – so my last thought is that in order to have institutions that effectively work toward the common good, it's not just – required that we have institutions of democracy in place. We also need underlying culture, an underlying culture of trust, an underlying culture where we may not agree with each other, but we're able to talk to each other and work towards something that's worthwhile for all of us.
This is Local Talk, and I'm your host, Jim Werbel. We've just heard from Peter Rossum and Clark Wolf talking about the topic of Commonwealth. The interview is available at khoifm.org in podcast form. Our next guest on this topic is Mary Rankin. Mary is the Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames. She works with all city departments in trying to increase their sustainability. We'll be talking about managing trash today in the City of Ames. As such, our local Commonwealth expands through these efforts. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
What I'd like to ask you is what does it mean to be a sustainability coordinator for the City of Ames?
Well, sustainability has so many different meanings to different people. Generally, in looking at sustainability, we're looking at taking care of the needs of our current generations, our folks that are currently in Ames, and then being very mindful to the generations that come after us. But sustainability really has three facets. It has an environmental piece related to our resources and the things that we depend on a day-to-day basis. It also has an economic piece, which looks into the health of our economy, people being able to have viable livelihoods, and us being able to have resources that allow us to continue to develop, grow smartly, and continue to do research. And then there's a social piece, and that has to do with the vibrancy and resiliency of a community wanting to give back, wanting to be a part of ensuring that sustainable future.
Well, we're community radio. We definitely understand the
people side. That's exciting, yes.
Well, we agreed we were going to talk about waste management today, which definitely has environmental, social, and
economic pieces.
Economic pieces. Now, I've heard from many people believe it's not really a problem in the city of Ames because we burn everything.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment. And what I would say is that, of course, we have a really unique and unprecedented system here in Ames with our resource recovery system, which takes garbage, mingles it with coal, and provides electricity for our community. It was, in fact, the first of its kind in the United States and also one of a very few that still remain. But that system certainly has certain limitations. It is built to be able to do certain things. And one of the things that it just isn't able to do is to take everything that comes into it.
It doesn't take everything.
Well, we take everything at the Resource Recovery Center, but then some things may need to go to the landfill from there.
Ah, I see. So, well, then what percent of it, approximately what percent of city waste goes to landfill then?
Well, on the average, and this, of course, depends upon what material comes in and how the system is functioning, from time to time. But on the average, we're able to use 65% to 70%, and sometimes a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but usually around that range. Now, that's really amazing if you consider the fact that most municipalities in the state of Iowa are really challenged to divert 25% of their material. So where that's a goal for most other municipalities, for us, we're really knocking that out of the ballpark. However, there still lies the fact that, gosh, couldn't we be even that much more efficient with the material that's coming into the system that we have and making it as efficient and as effective as possible?
So trying to be even more sustainable.
Exactly.
And reduce the landfill expenses. By the way, where is the landfill that this 30 to 35% goes to?
So it's actually in Boone County. And so we work with our folks over in Boone County. We do not have our own landfill here in Story County. And so we have to rely on that relationship, that partnership, that collaboration.
Well, what types of things go to the landfill that can't be burnt?
Right. So some things for us to be more aware of and to consider keeping out of the waste stream. First of all, liquid waste. Okay. If it's wet, it's not going to be effective to burn.
Nope.
If you consider what that usually is comprised of, it's usually food waste that we put into the landfill. And so some things to consider related to food waste, for example. And you know, this gets back to the old 3 R's and 4 R's we learned in school, you know, the reduce, recycle, reuse. And then depending upon, who you may be talking to, I always talk about the other one being rethink. Okay. First of all, do we really need what we're going to purchase? And so when you go to the grocery store, for example, oh my gosh, they might have that you can get 5, containers or, 5 pounds of this or, there's a special deal going on. If you really don't think you're going to use it, it's not a good deal because that's just money going down the drain, right? So buy what you need. That's going to help you with the waste on the other end. But if you do have waste, there's a few things to consider. First of all, there's composting. And compost is some of the richest, most valuable fertilizer that we can apply to plants and even to our lawn, and particularly our gardens. And so that would be money we would be spending otherwise.
Now, a lot
but
of people
we can make it.
Don't know anything about composting. How do you learn about composting?
Well, and I will tell you, actually, Iowa State University Extension has wonderful information on composting. And, of course, we have offices and resources in all of our 99 counties, most definitely including Story County. So I would encourage people, first of all, to go to the Extension website on the Iowa State page. You can just go and look under E for Extension, or you can do a search for Extension. And then within the Extension page, there are different publications, and there's a couple about composting. So that can be something that gets folks started. Otherwise, like I said, we have wonderful specialists that would be more than happy to talk to folks. But there are many different ways to compost, sizes and shapes and volume and all that sort of thing. So people certainly shouldn't be intimidated by, I need a specific type of container in a specific location. People do it inside with worms, too. I mean, that's a whole nother area
Yes.
you can go into.
Right. Well, so food waste is a major thing that needs to be gotten out of the waste stream. One of my frustrations is that now that the redemption center is closed down, we've been struggling to find what to do with glass bottles. What the heck do you do with glass bottles?
Well, and that's a really good point. That's another thing absolutely that the Resource Recovery Center would like to keep out of the waste stream. Glass melts. It gets kind of caught in equipment, and it just does not help with the efficiency of that equipment running, okay? Let alone if it burns or not. We want efficient equipment. And so the city has actually provided glass recycling containers around the community. There are big yellow drop-off bins. They are at both Fairway stores, at Hy-Vee locations, and you can also go on to the City of Ames website, search for a resource recovery system, and then on the left side menu will be information on glass recycling, and it lists all of those drop-off areas. That's free of charge to residents in the city.
So the grocery stores are basically a place outside the grocery stores.
Yes, absolutely. And the Hy-Vee locations are near the gas stations, and so you would look for them there. But they're big yellow drop-off bins. Really hard to miss once you see your first one.
Okay. I think a lot of people know about yard waste. Can tell us a little bit about yard waste, which needs – there's a lot of yard waste. I'm always amazed at what shows up at the yard waste site.
There's a lot of yard waste, and you know we're getting into that season, right, where
right.
we're going to start having that fall waste, and so it's a perfect time to be talking about that. That's also something that actually cannot be landfilled by state code, and so we look for other ways to utilize that. The city assists us by offering free yard waste days. Now, they certainly have a facility that is available during all of the fall season and all of the spring season that materials can be dropped off at a charge, but they also have free waste days to assist residents. And so this fall's free waste days, just to get that out there, and certainly it's on the city website as well, again under the resource recovery system, and if you look for yard waste. But October 24th, November 21st, and December 5th, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. will be free drop-off. And then November 7th, there is a brush-only day, also those same times. And so again, more information and a number to call for specifics on the city website.
They keep moving those dates later and later and later. I won't say anything else, but it's very interesting how they keep pushing those dates back.
Yeah, I don't recall we were doing much raking on December 5th last year, but you never know, right?
Well, as we know, July 30th has just passed, and I saw all sorts of waste. Can the resource recovery take any of the things that people who move out of apartments on July 30th, what happens to all that waste?
Oh, my goodness, the big bulky waste. Yeah, bulky waste is a challenge for the city system, again, because it's not something that the equipment that we have available can really process.
And there's a lot of it.
And so when loads like that come into the resource recovery system, oftentimes they are just sent directly to the landfill because they just know it's not going to be efficient to dump it all out and sort the material. And so they look at it. It's enough percentage of that material that it goes directly to the landfill. And we certainly don't want to landfill any more material than we have to. And so the thing with that particular waste is if we can consider donation. There are so many folks in our community, organizations in our community that could be benefited by some of these things that we don't need anymore, we consider to be a waste item, but yet would be very, very beneficial for people in our community. And so there are a number of different donation outlets, but some of the most obvious ones are outlets such as Goodwill, Salvation Army. In fact, Salvation Army will actually arrange for pickup for particular items.
If you don't have transportation, they'll come to your house?
Absolutely. You can call them. They have specific parameters, but they can come and they can get it from you, which is a really nice service. Of course,
that's Salvation Army only, right?
Yes.
Goodwill
yes.
will not.
Exactly. At this point, Goodwill is not offering that service. Habitat for Humanity, though, just a few blocks from the studio here, they do offer some pickup service as well. And so there's three great organizations that will take the real big bulky items. And, of course, they will also take some of the smaller items. We have a brand new overflow thrift store mm-hmm. on Duff that takes a number of different items. And then for things such as books, I mean, think of all the books we have, right? Textbooks, all these other things. Raising Readers program here in our community is a wonderful outlet, donation outlet, to increase literacy, you know, within our community, and they accept those donations. But also, if you just think about your favorite nonprofit organization, many of them have wish lists on their website. And not only can it be for items that have finished their useful life with you, but it can also be items that if you do go to the store and you were you know, tempted by that, let me get 10 rolls of toilet paper or 10 rolls of paper towels, and then you find, what are we going to do with these? They have needs for those as well, so you don't have to toss those. Okay. So there are a lot of different considerations.
You have to look about it. Are some of those at the sustainability, City of Ames sustainability website, what to do with major items like that when moving?
We are actually, I will definitely say the resource recovery system within the City of Ames website has information about these primary players. I will also mention that I worked with an honor student last semester at Iowa State University. She put together what was called a Pay It Forward database, and we are currently getting that ready to put on the Ames site that has a listing of all these different nonprofit organizations okay. And some of the items they will take.
Is there something that can help businesses recycle better?
There is a wonderful resource for businesses, actually, through the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. It's called the Iowa Waste Exchange.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, this is a free service for Iowa businesses, and the intent is to consider those waste materials or waste streams that businesses may have that could be beneficial to another business, another organization, another initiative.
So they might actually make some money on their waste?
Potentially make money, but most definitely save money.
Okay.
Because even if they, you know, even if it was offered as a free donation, that's saving them money from having to transport it through a waste agency,
okay.
right?
Right.
So there's that consideration as well. But there have been so many really wonderful connections across Iowa with the Iowa Waste Exchange. In fact, we've used them quite a number of times at Iowa State University when we have items that our ISU surplus system, you know, initiative or program mm-hmm. at Iowa State says, yeah, this really isn't going to be something that we feel that we can resell, then we look at the donation option, and we have made connections with a number of nonprofits across the state on items that otherwise would have ended up in our trash stream and probably the landfill.
So if you're a business owner, how do you contact the DNR? Who do you talk to? What person or agency?
Yeah, no, that's a great questions. For more information, if you go to the DNR website, which is iowadnr.gov, you can do a search for the Iowa Waste Exchange. Otherwise, the website is really big and long, so it's the easiest way to get to
Iowa
it.
Iowa Waste Exchange.
Iowa Waste Exchange. And then on that website is a map of the different territories. The particular person to contact here in Story County is Shalene Codner. Her name and contact information is on that sheet. And otherwise, just information about the program itself. They can also come in and help you identify areas of potential efficiency related to your waste stream. So you don't even have to sometimes, as a business owner, say, I've got a particular waste I'm trying to get rid of. They can come in and they can assist you in that way as well.
What about things like microwaves, large appliances? What can people do with those?
Well, in some cases, if they're working, some of these donation outlets will take them. If they are not working, there are a number of electronics recyclers. Most of them are a little further out than our immediate community here in mm-hmm. Ames. And one particular place, we do have some recyclers in town. And so I think the best thing to do related to that, certainly call the resource recovery system. They can help you find connections related to that. Another thing would be on the Iowa Department of Natural Resources website. If you look up appliance recycling, there's information on there. But most definitely on the city website, there's information, okay. a little tab about appliance recycling.
Well, I'm going to ask you two more questions.
Sure.
We're going to have to cut it short.
Okay, all right. but
Mary, Mary said she'd come back and talk to us about other issues,
which
I think will happen. Some places in Europe, because I just came back from Europe, have local depositories scattered all over an urban area. Now there's more urban density in the city of Lisbon and other places in Europe than there is in the city of Ames.
Mm-hmm.
Any chance Ames will get anything like that in the future where there could be some depositories?
Well, you know, I think Ames is a city where nothing is impossible. And so at this point, it's not one of the items I'm specifically working on. But I think as we continue to look at different opportunities, have different conversations, have different, you know, folks in the community such as yourself, you know, coming up with different ideas, I think the city is always very willing to sit down, have discussions, look at things, and implement what makes sense in our community and what is going to be of good service for our residents.
Well, as Peter just said, usually the city of Ames and their political discussions, they tend to be relatively more reasonable and sit down and do some serious problem solving to improve the Commonwealth. And maybe things like that will happen. Well, thank you, Mary. It was good to have you on the show today. And I look forward to hearing what's going on with sustainability efforts in both the city of Ames or Iowa State. Mary also works with Live Green at Iowa State, so to hear what's going on in both locations to make this region a more sustainable place. Thank you, Mary.
It's most certainly my pleasure. I would also add more information about what the city's doing. Go to the city website and click on Go Green. And also at Iowa State University, you can go to our website, livegreen.iastate.edu. I'm very happy if people want to contact me to answer any questions that might have come up as we've had our discussion today, any more information. Always happy to be a resource.
We'll put some of those links on the website and the podcast for this show. So we'll be certain they all get there. We've just heard from Mary Rankin, who is the Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames Sustainability Efforts. For all the caucus junkies here, the political calendar goes as following. At the Iowa State Fair, most of you know about that soapbox, Ted Cruz is talking today at 1 p.m. Tomorrow, Saturday, Chris Christie will be at 11 a.m., and Bobby Jindal will be speaking at noon. Other appearances in this week, mostly in Des Moines, Ted Cruz rally for religious liberties at 6:30 at the Convention Center in Des Moines. Saturday, there'll be a Rand Paul barbecue at the Iowa Rand Paul office on Bell Avenue in Des Moines. On Tuesday at 6 p.m., Bobby Jindal speaks at the Fisher Community Center in Marshalltown. And then Wednesday at noon, Governor Pataki will speak at the Des Moines Embassy Club on Grand Avenue in Des Moines. Don't hesitate to challenge any of these people or any others that you may hear about Commonwealth issues that we talked about today. I do have one special announcement to make. You've been hearing a lot about it, but on Sunday, August 23rd, we're having our third birthday party for KHOI, 3 years of broadcasting. We'll be having Nicholas Johnson, a former FCC member, who will be speaking about the future of radio at the First United Methodist Church in Kellogg Street at 3 p.m. This will be followed approximately at 4:30 at Bar La Tosca on Main Street in Ames. Everyone is welcome. There'll be free food and a cash bar. Donations will always be accepted to help the station keep in operation. The song we heard on today's show was by Vivaldi, the Violin Concerto. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk was engineered today by Jonah DeGeese. On today's show, we heard from Mary Rankin, the Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames on Reducing Trash, and from Peter Erasm and Clark Wolf on the extended topic of Commonwealth. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Check us out on Facebook, and you can also listen to the show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's our station's moniker, khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your donations help make KHO possible. And don't forget to join us to celebrate KHOI's third birthday again, August 23rd. Check out KHO's website for more information. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.